coast. That's California for welcome to the January 25th edition of National Reviews, Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swain, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an author, a political commentator, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hey, bud. How are you, Will?
I'm good, man. I was just showing, before you jumped on, I was showing Brian and Glenn the view. I'm staying with my sister-in-law and brother-in-law down in Baja, California. And out of one window, I'm looking at the Sierra Nevada mountains. And the other side, I can see the beach. It's beautiful down here. I was invited by a fellow Californian not to come and move here and not to bring any more Californians because it's just perfect for them right now. They don't want any more of us. And it's fascinating, you know, people move to a place like Mexico to escape regulation and then complain that the place is not regulated enough. Kind of interesting. And these are mostly Californians.
I didn't know people did that. People move to escape regulation, so they go to Mexico?
The only people
I've ever known that moved to Mexico, not for like a job or whatever, but like moved there, it was because they could get something on the beach at a lower price than they could in California.
Well, that's right. And what a lot of the locals have said is that the newcomers, though, come primarily from California. They bring huge amounts of money. They gentrify the place, as one person told me, and they are upset. The old timers are upset at the newcomers because they are also bringing a habit, a reflexive, an impulse toward more regulation. They want the streets paved. And of course, you know, this is a place literally where you, and Brian's been down here, he said, for like a quarter of a century on, you know, vacationing. So Brian can verify this. There are literally like dogs sleeping in the road. There are a lot of unpaved roads around here, but there are homes that have been built by, you know, California bazillionaires that are just shockingly beautiful and big. You can come down here for what used to be an expensive lifestyle. But a lot of that has gone away. The prices are up and the housing is expensive. It's really a lovely place. So, hey, David, I wanted to jump into a couple of stories that, as I said earlier, are not on the run list. And you expressed shock that there could be anything that I might have missed given the length of the run list. But two great stories, LA Rams and the 49ers will be shooting it out at SoFi Stadium next weekend, this coming weekend, for the NFC Championship.
Huge story. St. Louis and the Bay Area represented. I mean, you got the western half of the United States covered here. That's great.
Yeah, St. Louis, very funny. But I wanted to ask you that seriously, because when I was a kid...
I am being serious. I think it's amazing that Rams... Now, by the way, if you rooted for the Rams when you're a kid and then they came back, I get it. But I am really surprised that more people like did take them back. I would think people would have been mad at them. You know what I mean? I guess I just have a different view on it. But you don't want to get into that.
No, I do actually, because I think that's what's interesting. When I was a kid, I grew up with the LA Rams, and until their departure for St. Louis, I was a huge Rams fan.
And so you would say when they were playing in the Coliseum, they were the LA Rams. And when they were playing in Anaheim, they were the LA Rams.
Less effect, weirdly, because I'm growing up in Orange County when that move happens, but it did seem inauthentic. And Anaheim Stadium's not set up for football. It really looked kind of hinky.
Well, you know, when Disney bought the Angels, they made it so they could never have football in there again.
Yes. And made it look like some weirdo stew of Disneyland. And I mean, it was just sort of weird, very kind of preschool design. But anyway, my interest is, when I was a kid growing up with the LA Rams, they represented Southern California. The 49ers represented Northern California values. I can remember the games between the 49ers and the Rams being infused with that kind of political distinction. And it doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, you were representing Orange County, LA, Southern California.
I just remember Eric Dickerson running like a gazelle. That's what I remember.
He was amazing.
I never remember politics.
I think that political football is a fun part of the competition, the distinctions between regions. But what do you do when LA is roughly San Francisco in terms of its political impulses?
I don't know, man.
You're not going there, huh?
I'm just not. I want to, because I kind of think that you're one of the most clever people I know in this stuff. And I love your, like, history, and I always have about you. I respect that, but this is a stretch, I think, but maybe I'm wrong. The idea that there like used to be a political divide between more center right LA and more left wing San Francisco, and that took itself out on the field with like guys like Eric Dickerson and Joe Montana. I don't remember that necessarily, but I don't want to away from your projection. I do agree with you that the cities are indistinguishable now politically, and the counties. I guess one difference is that those anti-capitalist liberals of LA County did spend $4 billion on this stadium, where I think where the 49ers play up in the Bay Area, it wasn't even a $1 billion stadium. So maybe there's that.
Yeah. No, I would never say that anybody else is required to see the game in those terms or in any terms at all, mm-hmm. other than just a sporting spectacle. I am saying that as a kid growing up in Orange County and watching the Rams, people hated San Francisco. And among the reasons they hated the 49ers or the Giants or the Warriors was because they are from like Hippieville and we're not. So
I get that a little more when you frame it as a social differentiation and a cultural differentiation versus a political one.
Sure.
Because I didn't grow up thinking Tom Bradley was a conservative and Dianne Feinstein was a liberal, and those were the two respective mayors. I grew up believing both of them were liberals, but at least Dianne Feinstein was carrying a gun around in her purse when she was mayor of San Francisco.
Is that right? I did not know this.
I swear to God, there's things I can tell you offline. I can't tell you on air. Dead serious. Yes.
Did she put the gun in your nose?
I can't talk about it on air. Let's move on.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was a Cowboy fan from the very youngest of ages I can remember. And that was despite the fact that, my favoriteest coach in the whole world was John Robinson from USC. See, I was born when he had replaced McKay at SC, and actually he replaced him the year after I was born, but I don't remember being sub one in Coach McKay. But I remember Robinson, and I remember Charlie White winning the Heisman at SC when I was 5 years old. And then I remember when my dad told me that the Rams had hired him, and it didn't really make me a Rams fan. And they played in Anaheim, and I also grew up in Orange County, but I kind of resented the Rams for taking JR from USC. And then years later, I resented them because we got stuck with Ted Tolner at SC, and I really didn't like that. But then what happened is people have asked me my whole life, why are you a Cowboy fan? Where did this come from? And I did a book report on Tom Landry in first grade. It was a diehard Christian, the coach of the Cowboys. And at the time they had Tony Dorsett at running back and Danny White quarterback and Tony Hill wide receiver. And it was the very tail end of Too Tall Jones's, career, but they just had a lot of like iconic, wonderful players. And Tom Landry was just such a man of class and dignity. And I became a Cowboy fan. And even though the Rams are in my backyard, those were the two reasons I didn't really jump on it. And then they go to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And then their owner was a sort of unlikable kind of wench of a human being named Georgia Frontier. And then they came back and everyone was all excited. And I just thought it was odd. Sort of like your girlfriend cheats on you and then you're all excited that she wants to come back to you. It's like, I'm sorry. I got a little bit of self-respect.
Yeah, really. And also you don't know when they're going to take up the next great offer to move.
Yeah. Like the Raiders, Irwindale, if I were Las Vegas, I wouldn't get too comfortable.
That's right. So anyway, my point there is just,
I love that we've spent at least 12 minutes on football, which right now so many listeners are furious. But they have to remember that you started this as a political story. So they cannot be mad at me because you really did the right thing. I guess they could be mad at me because I'm talking football, but you made this political and they need to give you the credit for that. And they do not realize that I have to go in 48 minutes and you have 174 links.
Let's get to the second one then and talk about the fact that we another kind of battle of California, if you will. You got Neil Young coming out and telling Spotify that they can they have to choose now. It's either him or Joe Rogan. And
by the way, did you know what the biggest part of this story was?
Tell me.
That Neil Young is still alive. I had no freaking idea. I swear to God, I thought Neil Young died like 7 years ago. I remember being like, oh, I love that guy. What a great songwriter. I thought the guy was dead. I'm not being funny. I literally like saw that headline. I go, Neil Young is alive?
Well, he's alive.
You know, Meatloaf died.
Who did? Yes, I saw that. Yeah,
Real Meatloaf. Recently.
Yeah, yeah. Meatloaf was never really alive for me. But anyway,
They say he died at 74, and I guarantee you Neil Young is more than 74, by the way.
I think he is, yeah. And he lives on a ranch in Redwood City.
I hope he has full-time help, because that guy's got to be 103.
He's quite aged and infirm.
Meatloaf looks like he was 84, not 74.
Yeah, kind of always. And then you got, you know, Joe Rogan, formerly of L.A., now moving to Texas, where he does his big Joe Rogan show from.
And but how does Neil Young think he has more leverage than Joe Rogan? What am I missing?
I'm with you. I mean, I like Neil Young an awful lot.
Oh, great songwriter. Really great songwriter.
Absolutely. Yeah. But he's going to Spotify with very little leverage, I would guess.
You could argue that Neil Young peaked.
in the 80s.
Like 53 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. With Russ Never Sleeps.
Neil Young telling Spotify to get rid of Joe Rogan is like Greece, like trying to boss around Germany or something. Like
it is like that a little bit. And it's just unseemly. You know, I know that this has probably already got to be out there. I haven't seen it myself, but everybody's got to be thinking about these lefties who become, you know, they struck me as anti-establishment. I love Neil Young. He was kind of an outsider. He was, you know, he couldn't even stay in Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young. So he was very anti-establishment, very much about getting back on at the man, but now he's the man. And he uses his little leverage that he has to try to pry out the voice of Joe Rogan. What's the offense that Joe is talking about? You know, that he has the temerity to question vaccines and the COVID protocols and public health. That's where Neil Young's kind of just a cranky old guy, I think, at this point, and, you know, sort of settled in his belief that he really matters. So I'll continue to listen to his music, but just, I guess, not on Spotify anymore if he follows through on the threat.
Yeah, well, good thing about a recording artist having a career start almost 60 years ago is turns out there are other places where you can find their music.
Yeah, what a shock. Yeah.
All right, so Joe Rogan is not worried about Neil Young. I am glad to know Neil Young is alive.
Hey, let's talk about
intense political debates of
football teams.
The Rams and 49ers continue.
Check and check.
What's number three, Will?
Well, let's talk about Kamala Harris. Great story in the Daily Mail. I loved the headline. So we've got Joe Biden getting into a big press conference. This is not the one in which he told the Fox reporter that, you know, or said of a Fox reporter that he was a stupid SOB. But before that one, he declares in a conference environment with Kamala right there. He says, this is the headline from the Daily Mail. It's a marriage made in hell. Biden tells Kamala, quote, "I love you. You always have my back." And she replies, "I do." In a toe curling message at a DNC event, as they are both hit with historically low approval ratings. So
let me give Will a minute here. Will, for those of you who can't see him, which would be all of you, is dying right now. And he's going to be fine. But I want our listeners to know that I have stepped in to give Will a little time. And I also want people to know that this is not even close to the first time this has happened.
But it's a great headline, right? For a major newspaper to say it's a toe curling message of the DNC. So here's the key paragraph. President Joe Biden praised his partner, Vice President Kamala Harris, for always having my back during a Democratic National Committee grassroots event Friday. That's last Friday, telling her, quote, "I love you," as critics continue to slam their first year in office. So he gets on this kind of Zoom call and says, "Hi, Kamala, I love you. You've always got my back. You're amazing. You're the best partner I could imagine." The president's applause for Harris, the Daily Mail continues, comes after he told reporters on Wednesday he thought she was doing a good job and would certainly be his running mate in 2024. I'm not even sure he's going to be in the run in 2024, but there it is. So we've talked an awful lot about Kamala and the stories about how she went has gone.
I do think it's noteworthy that he did actually say that. And I'm pretty sure if someone could fact check this, I'm pretty sure it's the first time that he has publicly discussed him running again, let alone Kamala running again. And so there's something interesting about that, because thus far they've just sort of ignored it. It's a little awkward. I don't know anyone at the DNC and the Democratic Party, Democrat voters, people I know that are high up and far down the food chain, all believe he's not running. And so for him to have actually said it, let alone the fact that he was sort of reinforcing that, yeah, I want Kamala, I think that was noteworthy. I was newsworthy. I was surprised.
Yeah, I was too. And, you know, for all the reasons you've said, in most of the stories you read now about that are kind of like a bill of indictments about Kamala's performance in the first year, they quote her supporters almost invariably saying something like she's been given these garbage assignments from Biden. You know, she's got abortion rights, voting rights, and immigration. And I'm thinking, like, how are these garbage? Like, these are the progressive core, right? The claim that voting rights are being infringed by Republican electeds. Or that abortion rights are being shut down and must be saved. Immigration is supposed to be like one of the key planks in the Democratic platform. If I'm not sure what else there is. But, you know, meanwhile,
well, you know who has a better chance of winning in 24 than Biden and Kamala as a ticket?
You're going to say everyone.
Neil Young and Meatloaf as a ticket. I think that would be a fresher, younger... All right.
Weekend at Meatloaf's, Mr. Loaf's. So
Meatloaf is a lot more popular than Kamala Harris. And that's true. Yeah. That's true right now as well. Yeah. Even in the last week.
More vital.
And Joe Biden and Neil Young are about the same level. But by the way, our producer, Mr. Tong, has texted me that Neil is 76 and Joe's 78 or turning 79.
Something like that. Can you check that, Brian?
You know what? People make a lot of jokes about Joe Biden's age and mental well-being, and he definitely is aged, and I don't think seems all there. But he doesn't seem 3 years older than Neil Young. I'd put them at least like a break-even. They're like a tie.
Wow. LSD is a hell of a drug, man.
You're telling me.
You're on it right now. So I wanted to just talk real quickly. I promise I won't get boring with this.
Don't say that.
Don't, because I'm really setting expectations too high. But Kamala goes to Milwaukee, where she touts the infrastructure plan by saying that, you know, a huge amount of the money is going to be used out of this infrastructure plan to replace the lead pipes that poison children in Wisconsin. You remember that whole debacle. But in this announcement, she says, you know, quote, "Here in Wisconsin, as has been said, $48 million will be dedicated in the year 2022. These investments will create," here's the key, "good union jobs. These investments will address the needs of our children. These investments will result in improved public health, the creation of more jobs." This is all in one sentence. "The infusion of support for important mentorship programs, and it's just simply the right thing to do." So we get the point here that this is really a jobs program in some respect, that it's not really just kind of a clean, like, "Hey, we need these lead pipes fixed." It's going to be union jobs. But I am constantly trying to remind friends of mine who really believe the story about lead pipes and Republicans and children dying from lead poisoning. I always direct them to that irrefutable conservative source, the New York Times, which was, I believe, the first place I read the details of the quote unquote lead poisoning myth, that there really was no lead poisoning. Now, I don't know if I included that in your show notes, David, but here's just the summary.
I don't know either, but is your implication that to have a lead poisoning story, there has to be lead poisoning?
I would say, as a former editor or just a human with a functioning frontal cortex, that might be helpful, but it's not maybe necessary. But it's just that these two toxicologists who were cited by the New York Times say after Flint's water was switched from Detroit's municipal system to the Flint River, the annual percentage of Flint children whose blood levels surpassed the reference level increased only molecularly, and that's not poisoning. It's just a level to be alerted, and that it's not possible, as these guys say, statistically speaking, to distinguish the increase that occurred at the height of the contamination crisis from other random variations over the previous decade. In short, no crisis. And yet here's Kamala once again, phony crisis.
The only thing I'd say is that I'm like you, really offended by the phoniness and the dishonesty. And in this case, it is Kamala doing it. And she's got to own that. And you and I have every right as the host of Kamala Corner to call her out. But there is something that has become very common in politics. And it's much more common with the liberal media. It's much more common with the left. But I do think the right every now and then does it. Where if you say something enough, it does just sort of become true. And it isn't really important, including to the people saying it, if it's true or not. And the rationale in their minds at varying degrees of self-awareness is the facts are kind of unimportant to the underlying narrative. So if there is injustice in the world and I use something that never happened to try to help injustice, it's all good. And I think that's a common thing right now. I'm not sure that Kamala is like out on an island making things up by herself.
No, I agree with you. I just think it's important to fact check our electeds and just point this out. I won't make a big deal out of reading the entire research paper on the show. I'm not Lenny Bruce, but I do think, you know, this is a habit. And when our side does it, you and I have ridiculed
totally
the same practice. You and I are not believers in the stolen election or arguing that, you know, COVID isn't real. So then Kamala comes out to California and does a helicopter tour of the San Bernardino Mountains to announce that in that same infrastructure package, there's now money for something called forest management. Mm-hmm. What is forest management? Turns out it's kind of like what you and I've been talking about on this show since the very dawn of the show, which is there are well-known practices, prescribed burns, timber clearing, you know, clearing out the wreckage of the forest so that we don't have this pile of kindling every summer that bursts into flames and then gets ascribed to climate change. So she flies out here and she says, hey, we got, you know, billions of dollars ready for California to help clean up the forests. You know, who's there with her is Gavin Newsom saying, this is great. We're going to do lots of good work. But this is the same governor who accused Donald Trump when he made the same suggestion to clean up the forest of being an idiot. You'll remember this goes back to 2019. I just went and looked this up again. Trump tweets out every year as fires rage and California burns, it's the same thing. And then he, Newsom, comes to the federal government for money help. No more. Get your act together, Governor. You don't see close to the level of burn in other states. Among other things, Trump recommends that you go out and you clear forest debris. Newsom tweets back. You don't believe in climate change. You are excused from this conversation. So, you know, again, Trump's in office. There's no sense in talking about forest management. Trump's out of office. Biden offers you billions of dollars. And suddenly there's Newsom showing up to receive the big rubber check. Do you want to talk about the story out of PJ Medium? It's called, the headline is Facepalm. Newsom apologizes for using word gangs. It's really quite a short story. Newsom really does just come out and say, first, he's talking about the smash and grab raids of stores. He's talking about the great train robberies we discussed last week in LA, yep, where trains are actually being hijacked basically at their siding and all their, you know, cargo is being lifted. And Newsom says, this is not one-off. This is organized theft. These are organized gangs of people that are coming out. And then when people call him out for using the word gangs, he says, forgive me for saying gangs. That's not a pejorative.
But did they call him out or did he just apologize on his own? Was there pushback?
There was, but that it was sort of ancillary. It was the same conversation where he says, forgive me for using, like his own filter went off with alarm bells. And he immediately said, I'm sorry for saying gangs. It's not a pejorative. They're organized groups of folks that move from site to site. So that's not gangs.
Well, I think that we joke around so much and there's so much dry humor and sarcasm and stuff. And like, like I was being really serious 10 minutes ago about I didn't know Neil Young was alive, and yet people could be forgiven for thinking I'm doing a bit. I did not know that gang was like a thing. Like, first of all, if someone said, oh, you guys are acting like a bunch of hoodlums, like you're in some kind of a gang and this is criminal, even then, which is clearly pejorative, I wouldn't think that to be offensive or racially tinged. But particularly the way he said it was explicitly not that way. He goes, oh, yeah, it's like a gang of people. Sort of like if I said, like, there's a gang of folks on the corner and I'm going to take another avenue to get around them or something. Like, it to me, it means plural people. I get that, like, the Crips and the Bloods are a real gang, and obviously I've been turned down membership into both, so I know. But what world are we living in that the governor of California had to apologize for that word in this context? And this is happening over and over again, and it was happening every now and then when you and I started this podcast, and now it happens every week, where the Babylon Bee and Onion and satire has become so indistinguishable from the news that I don't know what's what. I really don't. And if gang is a offensive thing, then, like, I can't even imagine what people think about what some of the stuff I say.
Hey, I'm going to skip ahead to this headline. USC fraternity parties must have security guards following abuse allegations. Most fraternities at the University of California will be allowed to start having parties in March if security guards are posted at stairs or hallways in fraternity houses that lead to bedrooms. This is the LA Times. Strict rules issued in advance of spring recruiting, they say, also known as Rush, follow allegations of drugging and sexual abuse of fraternities last year. Now, there was a lot of conversation just in my sort of social group that suggested there's a deeper problem here, and I think you'll appreciate this, kind of the crisis of responsibility. Some people were saying, well, this is the university really coddling these kids or demanding of them something that's extraordinary. So there were those, you know, two disparate, antipodal kinds of perspectives. But I sort of think, you know, the university has a responsibility in loco parentis to provide security for its students.
I don't even think it's a gray area. I think they absolutely have that responsibility. They certainly have that right.
But so some of the people were telling me, well, you know, the women ought to be trained, you know, about rape avoidance, and the guys ought to be trained. Well, that's going to go on too.
The women ought to be trained on rape avoidance.
Yeah. Like, don't go into a place where young men are drinking loads of alcohol and plying you with it.
Well, then so shut down the parties.
That's a possibility too.
No, it isn't. That's what it means.
Because there is a lot of underage drinking, of course, right? I mean, if you're at a university, you're probably under 22 if you're in a fraternity.
Yeah, and I'm against rape of 21-year-olds too.
Sure.
And again, I'm not getting into the rape, like, if is it consensual if the woman is into it, but then is drunk, you know, that whole thing. Look, I'm not referring to that stuff. I'm talking about the hazing. I'm talking about the drug abuse and then people that are overdosing. All I'm saying is, you're right. These are young adults and there's a crisis of responsibility, but this is university sanctioned. These are houses affiliated with the school up on 28th Street by the campus. That's university owned property. Okay. They have every right to do this. And by the way, Newt Rockne threw the houses off of Notre Dame in like the 30s.
Yeah.
And no one has complained about life at Notre Dame lacking any kind of social activity. I think people can go find a place to grab a natural light or a red cup kegger without being in a Greek party out there. So I'm not playing the PC thing or any of that. I'm just saying, I think this behavior is animalistic. And if some security guards are going to help tone it down, and they're not violating anyone's private property rights, then I'm all for it.
Continuing our conversation about children.
Did you go to 28th Street? Were you a Greek when you were there?
Oh, gosh, no. I was playing in a punk band. I did everything.
You thought you would go fight those people, right?
I played their parties. I wasn't fighting them. I just didn't like them. And then I married my first wife was a sorority girl. There's something about
my wife was in a sorority at UCSB.
But
then, like, my daughter will talk about joining a sorority and my wife says, no, you're not.
Wow. And the reason?
I'm assuming she's got a reason.
You're just going to walk away from that conversation. We've got State Senator Scott Wiener. We have a Wiener watch too. We've got a Kamala Connor and a Wiener watch. I know. I just love to say Wiener watch.
I know you do, but just move on.
The headline here is, I want to lower the age of vaccine consent from 18 to 12. This is a new legislation, Senate Bill 866. Scott Wiener has introduced it to, quote, lower the vaccine age of consent from 18 to 12. Why? Because unvaccinated teens are at risk. They put others at risk and they make our schools less safe. They often can't work, participate in sports, or go to friends' homes. Let's let teens protect their health. This is the same guy, of course, who famously introduced legislation that basically was Senate Bill 145, signed off on by Gavin Newsom, which allowed rape between gay men and boys if the boy was 14 years of age or older and consented to sex with a man whose age was no more than 10 years older. So this is a guy who's constantly trying to kind of press down the age, drop the age of parental consent. And here in the case of vaccines, can you imagine your child has, let's say, known comorbidities that might make vaccines really a problem? And without your consent, this now 12-year-old child who would be in the seventh or eighth grade at that point, I think, can go into, you know, any school official and say, vaccinate me. And by Scott Wiener's lights, that's totally reasonable because kids have a right to kind of fight for themselves, even if their parents won't.
Just so stupid. I mean,
these are final words, counselor.
How do these people have the freaking time to think about this? They know that there is no 12-year-old at risk on this thing, that we are talking about them getting an unprecedented medical autonomy from their loving caregivers over something that has a statistically 0% chance of killing them.
That's right.
What in the world is wrong with this guy?
Well, I'd love to know psychologically, really seriously, what is going on, because it does seem to me like so much of his legislative energy is spent edging parents out. And
it's got to be virtue signaling. It's the only thing I can think of. It can't be science. It can't be like, I remember there were a couple people that they're like, I have a 5-year-old kid, you know, I cannot afford them. You talk about masks at school. And I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, they might be serious. So I don't want to be rude. It could be that some people are that dumb, that there could be that much ignoramus is going on here. I don't think so. I think this is just posturing and virtue signaling and, you know, just general disdain for the institution of family, undermining of social norms that have helped preserve civilization, a statist idolatry that believes healthcare bureaucrats to have a better position on what loving caregiving is for a child. Look, these people actually been doing this type of thing for a long time, but generally it's been done with a little more prima facie support than a 0% flu killer.
Well, I think that there doesn't need to be evidence when your ideological inclination as a progressive, and please hear me on this. Like, I don't think that progressivism, at least early on in the 19th century into the 20th century, was not necessarily a feature only of the left or the Democrats. It was, in fact, kind of the elite fantasy in most major universities. We've seen this before. We talk frequently here about how the progressive impulse in California has led to pushing parents out of the driver's seat and raising their children in the schools. This is just part of the same, again, emerging cycle of, I would argue, progressive elites left and right in California over 150 years trying to push the family out. The family is, we talked about this last week when we were talking about the very funny parody piece by Joe Matthews in the Chronicle, in which he was saying that, you know, we should just get rid of the family and basically have all kids raised in common. But that's where this is headed, the same sort of progressive impulse. Switching to sports one more time, I promise. One of the billionaires who is a Golden State Warriors part owner, This is, and you'll pardon me, I really can't pronounce the name. I think it's Chamath Palihapitiya. Pardon me. I'm not trying to mock the person's name. I just have a hard time saying it. has come out and said that that basically nobody should give a damn about the Uyghurs. He was asked specifically about the NBA's stand on China and sports boycotts and that sort of thing. And he said, hey, look, you know, here's the, I'm going to tell you a hard truth, brother. It's just not that important to think about the Uyghurs. And he tried to walk it back by saying, I'm sorry if I offended people. I meant no offense. But he says, you know, I'm telling you a very hard, ugly truth of all the things that I care about. This is below my line. I care about the fact that our economy could turn on a dime if China invades Taiwan. But if you're asking me, do I care about a segment of a class of people in another country? No, not until we can take care of ourselves will I prioritize them over us. There's kind of this relativist sense that America, he could be saying, like, look, I'm much more focused on how things in America go for the poor than I am about some people in a far corner of the universe. And that could be a very conservative thought, but it did not strike my ear or the ears of a lot of other people as that. It sounded much more like I'm going to explain away my financial impulse to make sure I don't criticize China by pretending that it's really a kind of out of a populist me first or America first sensibility.
Yeah, I mean, are you familiar with this guy? Did you know who he was before this?
Nope, not a peep.
I was kind of amused because this story ran. I had to reach out to a couple of conservative friends of mine because they were repeating the narrative about the war. The Golden State Warriors owner was saying this. Well, this guy's on CNBC at least a couple times a week. Mm. And it is true, he has a little piece of the Golden State Warriors. It's very, very small. Mm. He's not on the board. He's not operationally involved, but he's a very, very well-known guy in finance. So it has nothing to do with the Golden State Warriors. Mm. So I do think that there was a little disingenuous. And I actually think for some of the clickbaiters, it was on purpose to link the liberal NBA and the culture war stuff with the NBA to these guys' comments. In reality, this guy is a culture war liberal Silicon Valley, or has been real involved with SPACs. He's just kind of a loudmouth, and he's a shock jock, likes to say things for attention. And I think he's kind of a tool personally, but so yeah, his comments were reprehensible, but I don't associate them as anything representative of the Golden State Warriors or NBA or what have you. Now, is it possible a whole lot of people think the stuff he said? Maybe, but there is something worse about saying it. And then he did double down. Like, he really did put enough color around his comment that he didn't allow for a walk back, even the walk back he himself tried to do, because he didn't say, he went out of his way to explain like why they don't care and why it just, there's not enough time to care and there's other things going on and so forth. But I think that, you know, the lack of moral clarity on the way a whole lot of people in corporate America, in the media, in professional athletics, in Hollywood treat the nefarious actors of the globe, I think it is a big problem. And this guy's comments were an indictment there. But I just thought I'd add my piece about the Golden State Warrior thing. I don't think, like, I'll give you an example. My friend Anthony Scaramucci owned $5 million of the Mets. And I think the Mets sold for like $3 billion to, or $5 billion or something. It was like billions, multiple billions to Stevie Cohen, who's a big, big hedge funder. And if people have been running stories like Scaramucci, owner of the Mets, says blah, 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 it's not dishonest in the, you know, like, I guess you could say I own McDonald's. I'm an owner of McDonald's. You know, I own stock in a whole bunch of companies that people wouldn't believe. It's not quite that extreme, but my point is this guy is a Silicon Valley clown and a liberal financial media clown. And there's a lot of relevance to that. And I think that from a more valuable part of the story.
Well, let me ask you though, what is the responsibility of a business owner when it comes to trade or investments in a place like China, a country which I happen to think we're going to have a showdown with fairly quickly? over things like Taiwan, for instance, or travel routes in the South China Sea.
Are we going to invade Taiwan, or are they going to invade Taiwan?
I would say the betting odds would be in favor of China doing something to launch an incursion into Taiwan. You don't think so?
But when you say betting odds, that's definable. And their 10-year bond yield would suggest, and their currency going up against the dollar 9 of the last 10 years would suggest that the bettors with real money are betting differently. I am of the view that they would invade Taiwan in a second, and that they believe the U.S. would do nothing about it, and they could be right about Biden doing nothing about it. I'm not of any belief that they have the moral resistance to such an idea, but I don't think it is accurate that strategically it's in their best interest at this time. I also think that could change, but when you say imminent, I just disagree. I think right That's now fair. China has a really significant strategic imperative to harness their financial leverage by being one of the only countries on Earth to have a export advantage, and to not have used their central bank to lever up their economy. And right now they want trading partners, and they want more transactions in their currency. They deeply resent the leverage the United States has by our dollar being the world's reserve currency. And so my view for some time has been that the country that suffers most by interventionist behavior in Taiwan would be China. And so, again, I think we're agreeing about their moral inclination, but I'm disagreeing about their strategic preference.
Well, pardon me for even bringing in the possibility of a military showdown, just saying that let's make it an easier question and pull back from talk of war on my part and just say, look, we've got a crisis of morality here. You've got a country which engages in the kinds of human rights violations that make, pardon me for saying the obvious, the murder of George Floyd pale. You know, you've got hundreds of thousands, if not more than a million Uyghurs locked up in concentration camps and engaged in forced labor. My question is, and I'm not unique in saying this, obviously, but which country's values are in the ascendant in this relationship? The argument for a long time on the right was, we need free trade. Free trade's great, and it's going to make the Chinese more like us. And in fact, I would argue that this guy from, the Warriors minority shareholder, or more recently, this guy, Pat Gelsinger, who's the CEO of Intel, who has said that, he rescinded an order to bring his country into compliance with U.S. State Department guidance on China by insisting that no labor could be carried out in a particular region of China. And I bring this up because Intel, here's my probable hook here, my logical connection to California. Intel is a famous Silicon Valley company based in Santa Clara, I think. But Gelsinger, here's a story from the National Review. This is a guy named Jimmy Quinn. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger on Monday defended his company's decision to backtrack after initially asking suppliers to avoid sourcing components from China's Xinjiang region, you'll pardon me again, where Beijing carries out systematic forced labor abuses. During a webinar event hosted by the Atlantic Council's Geotech Center, Gelsinger said there's no real reason to specify forced labor abuses in Intel's notifications to suppliers because there are similar problems all over the world. So, there again.
Well, he elaborated a lot more than that line.
Sure. You want to continue?
I like Pat a lot, and I think that the conservatives in this case largely covered it with certain sound bites that painted a very different story. But your broader question is whether or not it's appropriate to trade with bad actors, and I think that we first have to start with who's trading with who. As long as we start with the economic fallacy that countries trade with countries, we'll never get anywhere with this. Countries don't trade with countries. people trade with people and companies trade with companies, but the fact that a company is based, do I believe that there are really evil companies in America? And if I was a German businessman, I'd want to avoid dealing with that company. I do. And do I think there would be good companies in America? I do. And do I believe that there are policies in America, like a school district in LA or Chicago trying to mask up and not educate children, that I'd be morally judgmental of? Or, you know, I don't know, abortion on demand, taking 1.5 million babies' lives a year. I would find it very problematic, but I would think that the transaction between a Duluth, Minnesota-based company and a Frankfurt, Germany-based company would happen outside the national policy of their respective domiciles. China becomes a lot more complicated because of state-owned enterprises. It used to be, it was 80% of their private economy was state-owned and 20% was private. And now that's inverted. It's now 80% private in public markets and 20 that are state-owned. So I think that every situation has to be dealt with individually. And like so many things we talk about, so many issues of the day, there's so much nuance that's required, and it just doesn't work in today's political dialogue that demands clickbait and demands a one paragraph piece to demonize someone. There's more nuance in where the policy ought to be, what the principles ought to be. And I think that the trade China discussion is one of the greatest examples of my adult lifetime of people almost going out of their way to refuse having a grown-up conversation about it.
So just to be clear,
you know, we'll take the rest of the podcast with this.
We needn't. But I just want to clarify. So this is, I'm quoting again from the National Review story, the flare up over Intel's forced labor statement began last month after President Biden signs into law the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. Legislation bars the import of goods from this province, where the State Department determined the Chinese Communist Party is carrying out crimes against humanity. So this is not an anti-China thing. It's an anti-forced labor thing that is specific to this region. So Intel originally jumps in and says in a supplier letter, multiple governments have imposed restrictions on products sourced from this region. Therefore, Intel is required to ensure our supply chain does not use any labor or source goods or services from this region. Here's the key. That sparked an uproar in China, including an editorial by the Global Times, a party tabloid, criticizing the move as arrogant and vicious. So Intel posted an apology to Chinese social media platforms on December 23rd. Quote, "We apologize for the trouble caused to our respected Chinese customers, partners, and the public." So that's the thing, I think. You know, it's not like all Chinese are bad or all Chinese companies are bad. It's specifically just, I think, Intel's readiness to capitulate because they were afraid of ticking off the central government with reference to...
Hold on. What is ticking off the government of China more? A comment that they made, or that they just spent $20 billion last week to go build competitive manufacturing shops in Ohio, and last year announced $20 billion in Arizona. So Intel here has a PR issue. And I thought Pat did a very thorough job explaining what he was saying and not saying, and why he was talking back some of what he said, which was more than just, I'm getting in trouble from the woke police. There was a lot more explanation and nuance to it, some of which I was satisfied by, some of which, you know, I just think these are issues of wisdom. Like, don't put yourself in this position. But at the end of the day, much like when people would say, look how kissy faced Trump is with Russia. And I would say, yeah, that Helsinki press conference was a nightmare. But you know what? He's pumping out natural gas like crazy. So I guess he ain't that kissy faced with them. And Intel, you know, they had this little press release back and forth, but they're going to war with them in the battle for semiconductor manufacturing.
Yes, right.
So I'll go there.
Yeah. So I'm with you. That was that's kind of the part two of my comment here, is that at the same time, Intel is investing in chip production here in the US rather. And the announcement this week in the last week was that they're going to build they're going to invest $20 billion in a factory in Ohio. The interesting thing there is I'm curious to see how much of the investment ultimately has to come from the federal government. Apparently, it's the Biden administration really pushing for this onshoring. I'm reading a story here, I think from Reuters, perhaps.
Well, no one has pushed for onshoring in American political history more than Donald J. Trump.
Right.
But the Arizona decision was before President Biden was
yes,
elected.
That's correct. No, but the Ohio is this last week.
They had said to begin with that their next location was going to be onshored. I think most of these things are going to be onshored for a little while. And I would argue with semis, it's not protectionism or economic, that there's a very legitimate Wilbur Ross, who I sat with at a dinner recently, who was Trump's commerce secretary, and at an event with Larry Kudlow, I got to sit with Wilbur. He believes particularly to semiconductor manufacturing, that this is the heart of the matter with China about Taiwan. And having more independence of our semi-manufacturing is a massive issue of national security. So that one issue might even transcend protectionism.
I was also interested.
I still think we're in California here because we're talking about Intel, right? So
yes,
I think it counts. And
also the fact that Intel decided to build its largest in the world chip manufacturing facility not in California. They haven't been building in California since the 90s.
What a shocking story that is.
Well, sure. And at the same time, it's more evidence of the fact that California has been declining in this manufacturing area for decades now.
It's line 1,184 on page 490.
Here's the I pulled out a story. I don't know if I put it in your notes, but it's from 1993. I found this story in the LA Times. I was trying to kind of track back to a time when California elected officials really cared about manufacturing in California. And the headline here is California loses bid for Intel factory. The number one chip vendor picks New Mexico for a $1 billion plant. California and Texas had been contenders. Well, now they're expanding everywhere in their manufacturing recently. It is Arizona, New Mexico, and now Ohio, not California, that's getting this kind of manufacturing site. And you can imagine why, because I guess sand is one of the major components for these computer chips that are based on silica or something, not a chemist. And the result there is that you can imagine what environmentalists in California would make of mining sand. This is terrible outrage. And what about the turtles? So it's interesting to read back this far in this, Intel kind of evolution that here we go. Let's see. The State Department of Trade and Commerce had special red teams trying to help businesses cut red tape and deal with regulatory issues. And California just couldn't get it through. But we had even Willie Brown, Speaker of the Assembly at the time, said that he was willing to look at all kinds of ways of reducing red tape in California, environmental and other business regulation. This is a Democrat, famously, back in the 90s, saying we got to make it easier to do business in California. I compare that with Lorena Gonzalez telling Elon Musk to F off when he decided he was going to split. So
yeah, whether it's Intel, whether it's Elon Musk, or whether it's those other 1,100 examples I cited, there is only one difference from one example to the next. And that's where there was intentionality and rubbing someone's nose in it, or it was just simply really naive, bad policy. But no matter what, it was all of the actions of people that created this steady and ongoing and recently accelerated defection of jobs from both large companies like Intel and Tesla and small companies that barely show up in the data that have undermined the cultural middle class in California.
There is so much more we could talk about today, but I am sensitive to the time here, David. Anything that you'd like to predict vis-a-vis the LA Rams versus the 49ers this coming weekend?
I mean, the Rams just clearly didn't deserve to win that game. They had a big lead. They had had a big lead against San Francisco in the last game of the year, which would have kept them out of playoffs. And they gave up that 17-point lead in the third quarter, came back and lost. The 49ers have been playing very well. But yeah, I think that the 49ers, you know, had a very miraculous win against Green Bay, and the Rams had a miraculous win against Tampa Bay after basically giving up, you know, what it would have been Brady's just unbelievable, you know, moment, as if he hasn't had enough of those. So I guess you got to say the Rams, cause I think they're a better team. But both teams seem very undisciplined to me. I think the more interesting thing is Cincinnati and Kansas City on the other side, cause they, you know, Kansas City's season was just as over gets.
Yes.
And then that of the four miracle games that happened this last weekend, that was the one. And that, that usually gives team a kind of new life. Like, you know, that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. To quote the great poet and philosopher, Kelly Clarkson. And I think that, you know, this could be Kansas City's, time, third year in a row in the Super Bowl. But as far as the California battle, if you had to put money on it, I'd say the Rams. But I think whoever wins that game loses in the Super Bowl. That's
wow. Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. All right. Well, that's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe and, of course, rate and review the show. Please email us with your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our personal emails and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at The Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi. That's the LA-based mariachi metal band for our intro music and our outro music. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima.